Vedanta teacher James Swartz on Bhagavad Gita. An audio workshop brought to you by meinyogalehrer.de, recorded in Yoga Vidya Westerwald Ashram in Germany on March 2013. Part 10 of 13.
Okay. You know, if you go out to the up in the Alps mountains in the spring, and you go to one of these beautiful valleys, you can see all kinds of wildflowers growing. It's a very beautiful sight. And if you pick several of one of each flower, maybe 10, 20, 30 flowers, each one of those flowers has its own beauty, its own wholeness, its own completeness, its own meaning. And if you take all of them and you take them home and you put them on the kitchen table and you take a vase, fill it full of water, and you start to arrange those, each individual flower takes on a whole new level or layer of meaning when they're put together in a beautiful bouquet, when each one is situated with reference to the other one in a perfect display of beauty. And we all have in us every experience and every bit of knowledge that we need. It's already in each one of us, particularly those of us who have been in the spiritual world for some time. We have it all. There's only one problem. It's not organized properly into a proper bouquet of meaning, so that the connection between each one of these flowers of experience and knowledge informs and blesses each other, and each individual part becomes meaningful with reference to the whole. And no human being can actually do this, put them all together. You can do it with flowers, but with all your experiences and all your knowledge, you can't do it. And that's why Bhagavan, consciousness or awareness, revealed Vedanta to us. It provides us with a picture. Have you ever seen those puzzles? You buy a puzzle and it shows the picture on the front, and all the pieces are all jumbled together inside the box. And you're meant to find all the pieces and put them together to make the complete picture. And Vedanta does that for us. So this afternoon, I'm going to give you the big picture. Whenever you have a doubt or a question, you can see just where the problem lies, and you can put your knowledge or your experience in the right place. Lay it to rest. Where we start in Vedanta, it's where you should start in everything. We start with our motivations. In this first inquiry, this is a series of inquiries, the basic inquiries of Vedanta. Our very first inquiry is called Purusharthas. The Purusharthas means my motivations, what I want. According to Vedanta, there are four basic motivations human beings have. Within that, there are many sub-motivations, but all of them basically fit into four categories. Security, it's called artha. Pleasure, it's called kama. Dharma, it's called virtue. And moksha, freedom. Those are four basic things that human beings, all human beings, pursue in one way or another. And all of those pursuits are pursuits of objects. I feel insecure, and therefore I want security. That's the basic one. Now, the way we conceive of security when we first come into life is financial security. Enough money, enough resources, enough wealth to make us comfortable and relaxed, for freedom from this sense of insecurity. If I have a good job, if I have money in the bank, if I have an inheritance, somehow I have enough money, I feel that I can relax and enjoy myself. This is a very natural desire to be secure. And why is it natural? Because nothing in samsara is secure, isn't it? Nothing here lasts. That's the fact. The samsara is anitya, it's impermanent. And we have this strong need for permanence, for security. We want to feel firm, secure, and comfortable. So we chase various objects. The second motivation is called kama. You know the Kama Sutra? You've heard of the Kama Sutra? That's a sutra or a scripture on kama, how to get pleasure. Not just sex, but pleasure. When I feel basically financially secure, and if you look at our cultures, you can see. In our Western cultures, we're basically financially secure. You may not feel that way exactly, but if you look at the culture, you'll see that the primary interest that people have in these cultures is entertainment. Computers are, the cell phone is not, you don't call on your cell phone anymore. Maybe you do call on your cell phone, but your cell phone is a huge entertainment device that you carry around with you to surf the internet, watch pornography, do whatever you want to do, listen to music, look for your keys, all kinds of entertaining things you can do, sports. Foreign travel, people love, the Germans are the most traveled country in the world. Germans travel more than any, why? Because they're one of the wealthiest countries in the world. They travel because they've got the wealth to travel. So they're not content, you're not content being secure. That feeling of incompleteness goes to what? Pleasure. I become a pleasure seeker. The music, the arts, sports, right? Everything. There's a whole huge world of pleasure seeking. And the third category of objects is called dhamma. Dhamma means virtue. There are some people, and a lot of spiritual people like this, maybe more spiritual people are fall under this category than on under the security and the pleasure category, these people want to be good. They do not feel virtuous. They do not feel good enough. This is a very common feeling. I don't feel okay, and I want to feel good. I want to be a good, better person than I am. And that's very, very common in Christian societies. In Christian societies, we're taught, even though you're not a Christian, all around you, people think there's something wrong with you. And you believe there's something, it's called original sin. Huh? The doctrine of original sin, the Christians, they tell you right from the beginning, you're a sinner, you're a bad person, you can make mistakes, you'd better be a good boy and a good girl, and you better do everything right, or you'll go to hell. And immediately you start feeling guilty and you start feeling bad about yourself. And so what do you pursue? You pursue all kinds of therapies and religious and spiritual techniques and paths and so forth. What? Hoping that you'll become a better person, a more honest, a more straightforward, a more truthful, a more kind and loving person. And many people think they're going to improve themselves. They're going to get better by being spiritual. It's because they don't feel okay. There are other pursuits. Some people pursue recognition. They feel nobody listens to them or notices them. And so they seek fame or recognition. They do really weird things or strange things or really succeed in some sort of way to draw attention to themselves. They'll wear purple hair and full of tattoos and nose rings and everything all over, and wear really weird clothes because they want people to recognize them, to know, hey, oh, notice me, I'm here. Behind that is always a very, very insecure, shy person who wants people to look at them and notice them. Or there's power seekers. This is a form of security also. They want power. They're chasing power. The politicians, often the police, the military, and even normal people. I know I was in an ashram one time when I was much younger, and the guru liked me. And the guru gave me a present first day I came. And all these devotees were there who'd been there for years, and they never got a present from the guru. They were mostly all women. And they were in charge of running the ashram. So they became jealous of me, and they used their power to give me all the dirtiest jobs in the ashram. I got all the dirty jobs, cleaning the toilets, cleaning the dishes, doing any, if there was a nasty job, they always gave it to me. They used their power to try to keep me down, because they wanted, the power people want to pull you down and put them up. This is it's a motivation. You see this in people all the time. And each one of these things that we pursue, we think it's going to solve the problem of pleasure, security, lack of recognition, or virtue. But as we analyzed this morning, these objects, the joy, the satisfaction, the security, the pleasure, the virtue, is not in the object, is it? We already analyzed that this morning. What we're seeking in the objects is not in the objects. We get the object, whatever it is, and we feel powerful, or we feel pleasure, or we feel virtuous for a while, for a minute or two, and then what happens? The feeling wears off, the security goes away. I start feeling bad again. I have to go and I find something else wrong with me and I start trying to fix myself to become a better person again. Or I feel powerless. Again, I don't feel I have enough power. And so, or I lose my power, then I have to get my power back. Or people don't will stop liking me and paying attention to me. And I start feeling small again. We said that joy is not in the object. What I'm seeking is not in the object. And after a while, we start to realize this. This is when we become spiritual. When you realize that the objects don't give me what they purport to give me. They claim it seems to me they're going to give me security, pleasure, virtue, and so forth. But on analysis, after experience, I discover they don't. I get a little bit of a happiness out of it, out of the objects, and then what? It disappears. And limited happiness is no happiness at all. Because any happiness that disappears just makes me unhappy. So object happiness makes me unhappy. Just a fact. And in Vedanta we say your first basic qualification for spirituality is the understanding that the joy I seek is not in the object. And then we analyzed where the joy is coming from. This morning we did, didn't we? It's a good inquiry. We discovered the joy is coming from here, from within me. And that's when we become spiritual. You start to hear, the truth is within. Seek within. Seek yourself. Don't stop playing around with the world. There's another state of consciousness where you can get to. You need to connect to something beyond the objects. They tell us like that. You all are yoga. You're out of yoga. You shouldn't be connecting to objects. You should be connecting to the self. They tell you there's this thing called the self or the higher state or God. You should find union with God. Why don't you get in connection with God? God's the best object. So let's go for God. And then you become a seeker of freedom. Because the freedom that you get from objects isn't enough. So then you look within for this freedom. What? From the sense of limitation. Okay, this is just something that happens to everybody at a certain point. You become an evolute, you start to evolve, you start to change. You move from the outer world to the inner world, and you become spiritual. Now, inquiry number two, when you become spiritual, when you start seeking God or the truth or the self or whatever, you start meditating and praying, your whole life changes. Your friends change, your activities change, everything changes. And you get in the spiritual world. You go to spiritual bookstores, you go to satsangs, you get on the internet. And you're not surfing the porn sites or any of those anymore. You're surfing the what? You're surfing the spiritual sites. You see all these people. Somebody sent me a link today of some guru. Said, I don't think she's a real guru. And would you please check her out? You know? And she's telling everybody she's an avatar and she's a guru and she's abusing these people and talking all this sort of stuff. So you get in the spiritual world. Now, when you get in, okay, this is inquiry number two. When you get in the spiritual world, you're presented with two ideas of enlightenment. You become, you hear about Buddhism, Dalai Lama. Dalai Lama is a media celebrity. What's the Dalai Lama about? Enlightenment. Oh, let's become a Buddhist and go for enlightenment. You hear this. You think, oh, that's a good deal. Enlightenment's a good deal. Dalai Lama's a nice man. Lots of Tibetan lamas there. They're all enlightened over there in Tibet. Let's become enlightened. Let's go to Buddhism.
He never says become a Buddhist. He always says stay with what you are.
No, no, I know. I wasn't saying he's telling you to become Buddhist. I'm saying you become attracted to religion or spirituality. That's all. No, this isn't criticizing any religion or spirituality or spiritual teacher at all. This is just saying that you become interested in the spiritual world. Now, in the spiritual world, there are two basic notions of what freedom or enlightenment is. The experiential notion of enlightenment, one, and the knowledge notion of enlightenment. 98% of the teachings and teachers out there in the spiritual world present enlightenment in an experiential, as an experience.
But normally a real teacher never says that he's enlightened.
Well, whether they do or not, it doesn't matter. We don't care what the teachers are saying. If you just look at the spiritual world itself, most everybody says that that the problem is you're suffering now, and if you get enlightened, you won't suffer. This is the idea. This is Buddhism. Buddhist says that. Buddha said that the first noble truth is life is suffering. And the last noble truth is what? Nirvana. Nirvana means what? Free of suffering. Free of passion, free of desire, and free of suffering. So, they're telling you that there is a state, or there is an experience, or this thing called enlightenment, whatever it is, that will free you from suffering. And that's good. That's what I want. Everybody wants it. We're not just saying the Buddhists, the yogis too. Yogis say there's a state, a samadhi state. You heard this whole language. There's a higher state, there's a samadhi state, there's a God to connect with, a Shiva and a Shakti. There's all this experiential idea. And what they tell you is, if you do this practice or follow this path, you will get enlightened. Maybe some don't, but 99% of them all tell you, follow this particular path, do these practices, and you will get enlightened.
But in the world Maya, maybe we need all these things to have a structure and love. Maybe some people in the world of Maya.
Yeah. That's true. That's what I'm saying. I'm saying, yes, this is all in the world of Maya. This is all in the world of Maya. We're in Maya, and the teachers are in Maya, and
yes,
and the techniques. Well, I'm not saying it's not okay. Okay, don't, huh? I can see people are trying to argue with me here. No, I'm not saying it's not okay. You're misunderstanding. Just follow the logic. Wait to see. You follow the logic and see if that's what I'm saying. It's all in Maya. I'm in Maya. The teachers are in Maya. The techniques are in Maya. Everything's in Maya. And they tell us we want to get out of Maya to God, awareness, truth, whatever you call it. Nirvana, samadhi, whatever. It's basically how it's presented. And when you first start, that sounds good. That sounds reasonable. And so you, instead of doing activities in the samsara world, in the worldly world, you do activities in the spiritual samsara, in the spiritual Maya. There's a worldly Maya here in the apparent reality, and there's a spiritual world or a spiritual Maya here too. And so you cross the line from the worldly world into the spiritual world. And there you do different things. You don't do the same things you did when you were out there in the world. You do different things. You do spiritual practice. You pray, you meditate, you, and so forth and so on. That's what the spiritual path is. And supposedly, when you do this technique, Kundalini, there's one, Kundalini Yoga. You know, you're meant to, what are you meant to do? You're meant to do all these practices, chant these mantras, live a certain way, purify yourself in a particular way, and so, and then you're going to awaken this energy that's down here in the bottom of your spine, and it's going to go up through your chakras, and it's going to pass out of your head, and that shakti or that energy is going to meet with Shiva, which means consciousness. They're going to come together, they're going to have a big orgasm, they're going to go into yoga or union together, and that union of Shiva and Shakti is going to what? Give me the experience of enlightenment. That's how it's sold. That's how it's told. And many people are, my first spiritual guru was a Kundalini yoga. And I practiced Kundalini yoga. And I had that experience. See, we're not saying there's anything good about it or bad about it. Mind you, not criticizing it or anything. We're just looking at it dispassionately and seeing if it makes sense. Now, what I want is freedom. Isn't that the goal? It's called moksha, freedom. I want freedom from desire. I want freedom from attachment. I want freedom from fear. I want freedom from dependence on objects. And freedom is that limited or is that limitless?
Limitless.
Yeah. Freedom means no limits. Nothing limits me. Nothing constrains me. We know that when we get involved with objects, we always get limited by the object. We get attached to the object. We need the object for our happiness. And so we get in a state of bondage with the object. So what I want is freedom. Now, let me ask you this question. This is a big, big issue here. This is a very important issue. And you, it may be very difficult. I'm sorry if I'm irritating you, okay? Because this is good. This idea strikes at the heart of the experiential notion of enlightenment. And it may be very painful for you to hear this. I don't want to make it painful. I hope it isn't painful. I'm not trying to be difficult, but it's my job just to teach Vedanta, and this is what Vedanta says. This doer, this person that's seeking, is that person limited or is that person limitless? Limited. So what I'm seeking is limitless, and the one that's seeking is limited. I think that's clear. Is it reasonable to assume that a limited entity, a limited person, with limited intelligence, with limited power, with limited energy, limited knowledge, is it reasonable to assume that that person can do an action which will produce a limitless result? No. It's not. It is unreasonable. In fact, it's impossible. Na karmana, na prajaya, danena, tyagini ke amritatva manasuhu. Vedanta says, not by karma are you going to get there. Not by doing anything will you get there. See, I want this experience of fullness and wholeness and completeness, and I want to get that experience by doing something. Now, with action, I can get something I don't have. Isn't that true? I can get rid of something I do have. And I can change something that I have with karma. Through my actions, I can, these three things are possible. But I cannot get something that I already have by karma. Yes?
That's how I understand it, that the doing is just the way. And then knowledge comes when the person is dissolved. The person is no longer there.
Well, no, that won't be true, because it's the person that's ignorant, so the person had better be there to get the knowledge. You can't.
It's just the self that gets the knowledge.
Yeah, I know, I understand. No.
So
well, okay, it is the self, but the self doesn't know that, so it's the person that needs the knowledge. How are you going to get rid of the person? You always have a person with you. And you can't, they say, well, a person should surrender or die or something like that, isn't it? Let's say the person should disappear. But the person's the last person that's going to disappear. Vedanta says you don't have to get rid of the person at all. The person's fine. We don't have a problem with the person.
Yeah, that's not what I meant. It's just a natural way that comes through practice, that the person is no longer needed. Or the identification with the
person.
Well,
but what's wrong with the person?
Nothing.
Then why would you want to get rid of it?
No, I don't want to get rid of it.
And it doesn't have to disappear.
No, but it does.
Well, I don't know that it does. Has your person ever disappeared? Except for a second or when you're in deep sleep? No, it hasn't. You always have a person with you. There's always a person. As long as you're here on earth, you're a person, you're functioning, you're thinking, you're walking, you're talking, you're eating, you're sleeping, you're a person. There's nothing wrong with the person or the ego or anything of the sort. Now, this is what Vedanta says. I don't want to argue about it, but because I'm just a teacher of Vedanta. Now, this action can only do what? Get something I don't have, or get rid of something I do have, or change something that I have. But can it get me what I already have? No. Can it?
It can make conscious of what you have.
Action can make you conscious of what you have?
No,
I don't think so.
No. Or knowing.
Knowledge.
Only knowledge can show you what you have that you don't know you have, isn't it? Action cannot produce a limitless result. Myself that I'm seeking, the freedom that I'm seeking, is awareness. That's myself. Right. Now, I have myself all along. And every time I'm doing an action, what am I saying? That I'm limited. Every spiritual action that I do doesn't set me free. In fact, it ties me more deeply to the idea that I'm a doer.
But then what about meditation? I mean, even in the
same with meditation.
But in the Upanishad, they say, go and meditate if you're still think you the self. Well, because you can think you're the self. So go and meditate. That's what's in Upanishadan said.
Well, it does and it doesn't. For meditation is for doers, isn't it?
That's the question, because I didn't get it now.
Well, listen.
Just don't do anything.
No. not at all. We're not saying you shouldn't meditate. We're saying you should meditate, maybe. Or maybe you shouldn't. You should understand what meditation can do for you, what spiritual practice can do for you, and what it can't do for you. Now, that's all. You're not going to get enlightened without doing spiritual practice, but no spiritual practice is going to set you free.
Yeah, okay.
It can, but it mustn't.
Well, no, the practice can't set you free. Why? Because you're already free.
Yes, it can.
No, that's not okay. Because people think... What's that?
It can do it with click off.
No, the cleaning.
Yes.
It can do the cleaning, yes. But cleaning's not freedom.
No, but you need to get rid of your old stuff.
That's right, absolutely. But what we're saying is that thinking that you can do some technique or follow some path that's going to set you free is not going to set you free. Because the person that's doing it is not removed. The idea in the experiential notion of enlightenment is that freedom is for the doer. That the doer is going to get an experience or a state or some experience that's going to make it feel free all the time. And when I get in that state, then I need to make that state permanent. And hang on to that state and get that state constant. My samadhis, they need to be sahaja samadhis. Those samadhis should be made sahaja. That sahaja means continuous or constant. This is what we're told.
So you can try some techniques, but don't expect that they will...
Well, but you won't try any technique unless you expect a result. Nobody does any action without expecting a result. No, I told you, this is a tough one. This is the reason I've gotten quite famous, is because I've actually had the courage to write this in a book, and many, many people now, thousands of people who have been in the spiritual world have realized that all this spiritual practice is not setting them free. It's getting them prepared to understand. We're saying, but the practices themselves won't set you free. And that's simply because what? You're already awareness. And what's behind this notion? In other words, what's the fundamental assumption that's made by the experiential enlightenment people? What is about the nature of reality? What is their fundamental belief in the nature of reality? Duality. They believe that that reality is a duality. And that what? I can what? Get a non-dual experience. Understand. That the experience I have now is not non-dual. It's an experience of duality. Isn't that how you feel? Isn't that your experience? Yes. My experience is, I'm here, you're there, I want this object, I don't have this. That's called duality. The object is something other than me, I need that, and I need that object to complete myself. That's called duality. Now, in the spiritual world, the object just becomes what? Enlightenment. It becomes an experience of enlightenment. It's not a physical experience. It's not pleasure, security, or virtue, or any one of the worldly things. Now it's a spiritual object that I'm told what will complete me. And that I can gain this by following this path, by doing these actions. That's what I'm told. But what if that's not true? What if reality, as the Upanishads say, is non-dual? What if that's the truth? It's up to you to sort it out. But this is what the Upanishad says. The Upanishad of Vedanta says, reality is non-dual. Now, what does that mean? That means that I'm always experiencing that there's only consciousness. Non-dual reality means everything is only consciousness. And if that's true, and you have to determine this on your own, then everything I'm experiencing right now is myself, is awareness. When? Tell me this. When are you not experiencing yourself? When? Never. You're always yourself, and you're always only experiencing yourself. You're never experiencing anybody else or anything else. You're just experiencing you all the time. This is just your experience. And the problem is that I don't understand that myself is everything, so I think myself is limited, and I think there's an object that I can get that will make me feel limitless. But because I don't understand that I'm always experiencing myself and that I'm limitless all the time, I don't understand that.
Is there any concept about why we have this feeling?
Maya.
Okay.
Maya causes this feeling. Huh?
Why do we have Maya?
We have this feeling because of Maya.
But why do we have Maya?
No, you can't. You can't ask that question. You know why? No, because there's no answer to that question because the person who's asking is a product of Maya. Maya? So there's no answer to why. How we can answer. How that works, how it is, we can explain. We haven't got into how Maya works. We haven't had time. This is a very short seminar. But that the fact is that what? I feel separate and incomplete and inadequate. I feel that reality is a duality. It's not. This is why we need investigation. And the scripture should be guiding our investigation. Now, think about this. If I'm experiencing myself all the time, if everything I'm experiencing every minute is awareness, is myself, then I don't have an action problem. I don't have a doing problem. I don't have an experience problem. Do I? What kind of problem do I have? An ignorance problem. I've got an ignorance problem. I don't have an action problem. Now this is very hard to get, you know, this is where you separate the men from the boys spiritually. Because under converting my desire for experience into a desire for knowledge is the what? The only conclusion that I can come to if I understand the nature of reality and the nature of myself, yes.
In your book you said you can't just understand this at that moment when you have really enough of experience. That's a qualification.
Yeah, that's right. We're going to get, in a few minutes, we're going to talk about more about the qualifications. But, yes, ma'am.
Isn't it also a problem when I have an knowledge suddenly, like a decision I make to be really in this moment, just with what the other person says, and then everything besides my emotions and the incomplete, I just put it aside, and then I am here, I'm just here, and then I see consciousness, awareness, and in the same moment, it's like a really big feeling. It's awareness, and then comes the feeling, and that is the problem because we get attached to this.
Well, the experience of awareness that produces a great attachment. It you never experience awareness as an object. You experience awareness as a reflection in your mind. And that becomes another object that you can awareness you can get attached to. But the point here is this. The point here is this, that to get what I already got, I can't do anything. That if I'm already awareness, if I'm whole and complete, and realities, I'm not separate from anything. Reality's not separate from me, and I'm not separate from it. If that's the fact, then there's something I don't know. Now, it's up to you to understand this. The scripture, this is what the scripture, I can't prove this to you. I mean, you either understand it or you don't. But the scripture says very, very clearly that reality is non-dual. That's what non-duality means. That there are not two things here. There are not two principles here. There's not me and objects. It looks like there's me and objects, but when we investigate the objects, we cannot find that the objects actually exist as something separate from ourselves. You cannot find any object out there that exists apart from the self, from the knower of the object. I recommend Greg Good's book called Direct Path, because there's some beautiful, if you want to see this experientially, it'll prove to you that there is no object out there, that everything you think is out there is actually just yourself projected. We've explained about Maya, how Maya takes awareness and projects it into objects. Understand?
This is clear. It's just not clear for me now in the moment how to get there. Because I've been for 20 years in Buddhism and in Dzogchen teachings, and I did a lot of retreats things. So, and I have my experience, okay?
Yeah.
And but it's still not clear to me how.
Well, wait, just take it easy and we'll get there. Well, explain it. But you see, we have to go step by step through this. I'm trying to take you all there together. And I always get a lot of resistance on this point.
No, it's not a resistance, because like you said, like awareness is like the sun, and we live in the reflection. Okay? Yeah. We're not the sun yet, right. So we have to do something to...
Okay, now we're going to tell you what you have to do and how to do it in a minute. But you've got to get prepared, huh? For the next step. In other words, you have to accept the logic in step two before we can move to step three. See, there's always resistance at this point, because I don't want to give up my desire to experience.
No,
but most people do not want to let go of their desire to experience. And we're saying that in order to get free, in order to understand that you're free, you have to convert this desire to experience things into a desire to understand who I am, into self-inquiry. In other words, I have an ignorance problem, and how do I solve ignorance? How is ignorance solved? Ignorance is solved with knowledge. This is the second path. This is the second approach to enlightenment. One is the experiential approach, and the second is called the knowledge approach. Okay? Vedanta is the knowledge approach. We're not against experience. There's no argument about experience at all. We're just saying that reality is non-dual. You're already experiencing what you want to experience. You're already fine, you're pure, you're perfect, you're whole, you're complete, everything's great, you're the light, everything's great. But since you say that you're not happy, then you've got an ignorance problem. Now, knowledge is a solution to ignorance. That's all. Okay, now point number three. Let's say you've accepted this, that I need to know something, okay? Now, point number three. Knowledge doesn't happen by itself. Okay? Knowledge requires a means. This is the third step in self-inquiry. The third step is, for knowledge, a means is necessary. For example, for you to see the snow, you need eyes. For you to hear my voice, you need ears. Those are the means. For the sounds, I need ears. They are the means that deliver the knowledge of these sounds that are coming out of my mouth. For you to see my body, you need eyes. They're means of knowledge for my body. For emotions, for feelings, I need a heart. If you have no emotional center, no heart, you can't feel what's going on around you at all. There's a whole world of emotions happening all the time. Every minute, there's a whole field of emotions. You're always in a world of emotion and feeling. And if you don't have a heart, how are you going to know what's going on? For feelings, you need a heart. That, so consciousness gave you a heart. That's called mana, manas. It gave you a heart. That heart is for the purpose of knowing and experiencing feelings. To understand what I'm saying, you need what? Buddhi. You need an intellect. Right? Your heart can't understand what I'm saying. You can tell what I'm feeling if your heart's working. You can tell what I'm feeling. If I'm angry, you can feel my anger. If I'm happy, you can feel my happiness. And whatever it is, you can feel it. But your heart can't understand what I'm saying. Your heart, it's just not possible. Because it's field of knowledge or field of experience is like a certain band of existence. And at another level, the ideal level, I need what? An intellect to what? Know what is being said. Now these three means of knowledge, the senses, the mind, the heart, and the intellect, are given by Bhagavan. For what? Experience and knowledge in this samsara, in the world. Those are God-given means of knowledge. Now, these means of knowledge are not suitable for awareness. Why not? Because these means all require objects, don't they? They all require objects. My senses require sense objects, my emotions require feelings, and my intellect requires thoughts. Those are the objects of knowledge. But the self can't be objectified, can it? The scripture said, you can't take the self and turn it into an object. How can you take yourself and push it out so that you can see it? If you push yourself out there, you're still here pushing yourself out, aren't you? You can never turn yourself into an object. Yourself is limitless awareness. And this limitless awareness cannot be turned into an object that you can know with your intellect or feel with your heart or experience with your senses. Just think of those. See the logic. This is just a fact. I mean, I'm not talking logic like intellectual logic. I'm talking the logic of existence. This is how it is. So I'm not going to smell consciousness. I'm not going to feel consciousness. I'm not going to taste consciousness. I'm not going to think consciousness. Because consciousness is beyond my means of knowledge. Understand this. I can read books all day long and it's not going to change anything. All I'm going to get is ideas. about consciousness, but I will get indirect knowledge of consciousness, but that doesn't do me any good. I want direct knowledge of consciousness. Now, how am I going to get direct knowledge of consciousness if I don't have an instrument to do it? How am I going to do that? Well, evidently God made a mistake, huh? God, I guess I can't know God, can I? I guess I can't know consciousness and know my creator and know what's behind me, what's creating me and what's making me. I guess I can't do that. No, wrong. Consciousness evolved another means, or revealed another means of knowledge that is available to me. A means of knowledge for consciousness alone. A special means of knowledge that what? Removes my ignorance about who I am, about consciousness. There's a means of knowledge for, specifically for consciousness. It doesn't work for anything else but for consciousness. Just like my senses don't work for anything but sense objects, my feelings don't work for anything but feelings, my intellect only works for ideas, there's a means of knowledge for consciousness. And that means of knowledge is called Vedanta. Now,
but still we need you to tell us.
Oh, we're gonna get there. We're gonna get there. I have to explain to you how this works. First, I have to understand that I need knowledge. Second, I understand that I need a means of knowledge. That's the next logical step in the spiritual journey. Now, how does Vedanta work? How does it deliver knowledge of myself as awareness? And it's been doing it for thousands of years. This is a proven means of knowledge. This means it, just like eyes have been proven for thousands of years and the mind has been proven, Vedanta has been proven for thousands of years to reveal the fact that I am limitless, non-dual, actionless, ordinary awareness. And how does it do this? Vedanta does not promise you an experience of awareness. Well, we already explained why, because you're already experiencing awareness. It doesn't promise to prove that you exist. There's a lot of people out there who say, you know, in the neo world, they say, oh, I don't exist. Have you heard that one? In the spiritual world, you don't exist. Tony Parsons, he's one of those famous ones. He'll stand in front of you and say, you don't exist, I don't exist. the people in that. Now, we don't have to prove to you that you exist. It's self-existent that you exist. It's obvious that you exist. You have no problem with that. And that you're experiencing yourself should be clear to you. So we don't have to do that. What then is preventing me from appreciating myself as limitless awareness? What's keeping me from appreciating myself as limitless awareness?
My attachment to the objects.
Ignorance.
Ignorance about myself. And what is that ignorance? What is that ignorance? That ignorance is beliefs and opinions and ideas that don't hold up under analysis. They're just beliefs and opinions that are not backed by knowledge or experience or logic, the logic of existence. If you look in the spiritual world, it's just full of ideas about who I am and how to get there. There's just hundreds of ideas, all cooked up by people who have no idea what they're talking about. But they present these ideas as if they're most incredible, wonderful ideas, most fantastic, mind-blowing ideas. And because we don't know anything about it, and they're talking about something that's not a matter of our experience, we just swallow all these ideas. It's very difficult for me to teach spiritual people. You know why? Because they've read all these books, and they've been to all these practices, and they've been to all these gurus. And by the time they come to me, they got a huge, huge mindful of spaghetti of ideas that just all wiggled around. And they're happy to argue with me for days and days about it, because they believe that these ideas are actually knowledge. There's a difference between knowledge and opinion. And ignorance is taken to be knowledge. Huh? If you don't know what knowledge is and you don't know what ignorance is, you can take ignorance to be knowledge. You can think that you know something when actually you're ignorant as a loaf of bread. So what Vedanta does, it is a series of prakriyas. We call them prakriyas. They're inquiries, investigations into reality, into myself, because reality is myself, I am reality, that knock off my ignorance. We've done several of them. We've done quite a few. The joy is, what is knowledge? The joy is not in the object. What is my belief? The joy is in the object, isn't it? Why do you chase objects? You think they're real and you think they can provide you with happiness. That's why.
And they are here.
Huh?
And they are here.
And they're, yeah, they're right there available. It's easy. The objects are easy. No problem. But that's the belief. If you understood what real was, what reality was, you wouldn't chase objects. And if you knew that you were joy, that you were happiness, you wouldn't chase objects, would you? So we have this belief that objects can have this happiness in them, that they can complete us. Now that was just a basic belief. And that belief, I don't want to let that go. Spiritual or not. Particularly when I've been told that, enlightenment is an object. Oh, I can get enlightenment. Huh? When I'm the light, I'm told that I can get enlightenment. See? Here I am. I'm the light. I'm awareness. And they tell me that I can get enlightenment. Now, huh? Hello? Hello? Anybody home?
And you have to pay 5,000. Huh?
What?
And you have to pay.
Yeah, we should pay. You should surrender to me or give me money or get in bed with me or something. I'll see to it that you get in my room. You are the light, Vedanta says, you are awareness, the light of the world. Without you, nothing exists. Everything depends upon you. Your nature is love. You're free. You're beautiful. You're pure. You're perfect. You're the source of everything. But I want enlightenment. These notions, ideas. And every one of our teachings, every teaching of Vedanta, how does Vedanta work? It reveals to you the unexamined logic of your own experience. We're not trying to get you to believe anything. We're not trying to convince you of anything. We're just asking you to follow along and check your own experience and see if what we say isn't true. It's all up to you. We don't want anything to do with it. We'll just tell you, here's the way it works. Look and see if that's not true. And this always proves to be true. That's what truth is. Knowledge is something that's always true. Knowledge is what you cannot get rid of. A belief, opinion, ignorance, a fantasy, any of those things can be dismissed as not real. But what the truth, you can never get rid of. So, okay, now, let's say I have agreed that I need knowledge, that there's no joy in objects, that enlightenment is not experiential. Enlightenment is the search for understanding, that am I aware of, and that I need a means of knowledge. That's four. Okay, so far I've agreed. Maybe you have, and maybe you haven't, I don't know. But let's say I've agreed that I need knowledge. Okay, now it gets more complicated. It gets more problems come up. It's always bad news at every level. There's good news at every level, and there's bad news at every level. What is the bad news now? Okay? The bad news is I need to be qualified to get knowledge. Ooh. Ooh. Not good, right?
Yeah, it's good.
It is good. But for Mr. Ego, it's not a good news, is it? Did you ever ask yourself why there's like millions of people seeking and only like a handful of people finding? Did you ever ask yourself that? That seems pretty strange, doesn't it? Huh? And yeah, that's pretty strange. If it's, you know, if the truth is you and it's here and blah, 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 why doesn't everybody get it? Why is it so hard? I'll tell you why it's so hard. Because I'm not qualified for it. See, just to get to this point, look at all the you know, difficulty it is just to get this far. I've got to like give up the idea that there's any happiness outside myself and stop chasing objects. I've got to give up the idea that I can do something to get enlightened. I've got to surrender to knowledge. And now you telling me that there's more qualifications. there are qualifications. You know how they came up with these qualifications. This is not arbitrary. They just didn't say, oh, this is an enlightenment club, and we're only going to let certain kind of cool people in this club, and the rest aren't going to get in our enlightenment club. So, you know, if you got a big nose, you can't get in. And if you got green hair, we won't let you in. And if you have brown skin, we don't let you in either, or white skin. Nonsense. It's not that. Those are not. It isn't arbitrary, these qualifications. How did they come up with these qualifications? How did they get there? They just looked at enlightened people and compared them with unenlightened people. And they discovered that all enlightened people had certain qualities of mind, irrespective of their path, irrespective of how they got enlightened, irrespective of their tradition or their race or their creed or their education or any one of those outer factors. They discovered that these people all had certain qualities, and they also discovered that those people who weren't enlightened but were lacking in those qualities in one way or the other. Ergo, therefore, what are the qualifications? These qualifications are laid out in one of our texts very clearly, called Viveka Chudamani, and they're written by Adi Shankaracharya in the 8th century, and they're laid out in great detail in that text. I have a think on one of the videos here that I have that we have the Viveka Chudamani text, which explains, and in my book also. Now look, if you want to be a doctor, you want to be a doctor or a lawyer. Please give me my law degree. Huh? You don't just walk out to the university and say, give me a law degree, do you? No, it's my democratic right. I'm a person. I have a right. You have no right to get a law degree. What to get a degree as a doctor or a lawyer or even a teacher. Even in Germany, I'm told, I was here with a friend a couple of years ago up in up near Hanover, and we went for a walk, and we went to this lake, and there were all these men fishing. And I happened to come from Montana, and our family had a fishing cabin on a beautiful stream in the Rocky Mountains, and I love fishing. So I said to my friend, hey, let's go fishing. No, it's just innocent. He said, no, can't do it. I said, what do you mean? I said, we'll just go to the fish store, we'll get some bait and rent some rods. And he says, you have to have a license. I said, so what? We'll buy a license. In Montana, you just go and you give them $20, they give you a license and you go fishing. It's not a big deal. You just put a worm on your hook and throw it in there. No, not in Germany. It takes like a year. You got to go all these classes. It's unbelievable what you have to do to get a fish, just to fish. To be a doctor or lawyer, 10 years, huh? Probably 10 years of study. You got to go through grade school, high school. Then after that, you got all these graduate courses and degrees and stuff. And then you're qualified to what? To teach, to study law, to be a lawyer or doctor. Now, why should it be any different for enlightenment? Huh? Why?
That's what I was just asking you the whole time.
It shouldn't be any different. This is the most difficult thing. You know why it's so difficult? Because it's so simple. We have got all of these ideas. Our head is just full of ideas about what we are and what reality is and what enlightenment is. We just have all kinds of ideas, and the thing is so simple that we're never going to get it until we're able to unravel all of this bird's nest of wrong notions in our head. And to do that, you need to be qualified. And what are the qualifications? You need to be discriminating. Now, what is discrimination? What is it? Discrimination is the ability to separate what's real from what is not real. What's permanent from what's impermanent. Okay? That's easy. No, that's not easy. Every day, this world is a world of appearances. You never know what's real in this Maya world. Huh? You're getting fooled all the time. Constantly fooled by what's going on here because you lack discrimination. And Vedanta says, you've got to learn to discriminate. You've got to, discrimination is knowing the difference between who I am as awareness and the objects appearing in me. That's called the objects change, I don't change. And discrimination is what? Knowing the difference. And being able to apply that knowledge on a moment-to-moment basis. We talked about that this morning. The second qualification, dispassion.
Can I just ask, I'm sorry, what is real then?
Awareness, limitless awareness, that's reality.
That's the only thing.
There's only one thing that's real, and that's you, awareness. That's it. Everything, anything that changes, that moves, that appears and disappears is not real. The only thing that's real is you. You never go anywhere, you never change. That part, that there's a, you can think of it as a part of you that's been the same all along. You know that part?
I think so, yeah.
Yeah, you do. That's you, that's awareness. That part that's been here all along and is here from moment to moment, that was here the day you popped out of the womb and will be here the day you die, that's what's real. That's the seer. That's awareness. That's what's real. And all the objects are not real. They exist. You can experience them, but they're not real. It means they don't last. Only you last. Only you are permanent. And that's your identity, your primary identity. So discrimination is being able to know the difference between who I am and the objects that appear in me. The second qualification is called dispassion. You can see how difficult it's getting, because why? Because I've got lots of passions, don't I? I have lots of desires and lots of fears. This is passion. And dispassion means what? We have a very, very technical and clear definition of dispassion. And what is that definition? Indifference to the results of my actions. Now tell me, who is indifferent to the results of their actions? How many people are indifferent to the results of the action? Not me! I'm doing it because I want the result. And if I don't get the result, I get all upset. Right? Why am I so emotional? Why am I so passionate and emotional? Because I'm not happy. I'm not getting what I want. I'm doing all this stuff, doing everything here, and I'm not happy because I'm not getting what I want. I'm not indifferent to the results of my actions. So my action, I'm doing all these actions and I'm not getting what I want. And I'm not indifferent. I don't say, que sera, sera. So what? Who cares? That's a dispassionate person. A dispassionate person. Why can I say that? Why can I not care? What's the reason why I won't care? And only a mature person can say this. Because the results aren't up to me. I'm no longer a child emotionally. I'm a mature adult. Adults know very well that they're not in charge of their action, the results of the actions, and they're dispassionate. We call this a mature person in Vedanta. Yes, ma'am.
For this dispassion, it's necessary to do the best I can.
Yeah.
If I got the feeling I did the best I
could, then leave the rest of. Sure. Yeah, that's right. A dispassionate person has that attitude. That's right. You do your actions, and you just stop worrying about it. You're indifferent. That's why we define it as indifference to the results of my actions. So that's really important quality. Why? Because all the time this thing called freedom is hard. It's not always present. And I'm working hard. I'm doing inquiry all the time. And there's a lot of frustration here. Like with Karma Yoga, for example. We explain Karma Yoga. You're not going to get results immediately, are you, from Karma Yoga? You will start getting results. You will notice small results. But it takes a long time to get rid of to clean up my mess. So I had better be pretty dispassionate about when my mind gets prepared. And I just better be ready to take an adult, grown-up idea, attitude toward it, and just plod along every day, steadily, 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 doing my spiritual work. And only a dispassionate person can do that. Because most people, if they're passionate, if they're immature, they want results quickly. And when they don't come, they get upset. They say, geez, I've been doing meditation for
20 minutes and I haven't experienced anything. I don't want to meditate, and off they go. Huh? They have no dispassion. They don't take their time. They're so fixated on getting the result that they can't do the actions properly. So, dispassion. What's the third qualification? Are we getting ready for a break? Yeah, I see some people yawning.
Too much qualifications.
Too much qualifications. And we haven't even got to the rest of it yet. We're still on qualifications. This is a big topic. Because the reason I need to know this is because if my spiritual life is not working, it's because I lack qualifications. And therefore, what I need to know where I'm lacking here. This is a checklist, and then I can work on what? Developing the right qualifications. That's all. It's not like this is a help. It's a help to know this. This is an important thing to know.
That's what I was asking before. What's my question? It's, you know, you're not just be in real life and don't do anything anymore.
No, that's awareness.
You know, I mean, this is.
No, that's not going to work.
Okay.
Yeah, so absolutely. We're not
back in the same.
There's nobody that criticizes the I'm awareness people more than I do.
Okay, good.
Believe me. Discrimination, dispassion. Sama, Dhamma. Have you heard these two terms? Sama and Dhamma? In yoga, you must have heard them. Huh? Control of the mind. How do you control your mind? By observation. Meditation is a good way to control your mind. You sit down, and you observe it. You keep... You can't control the thoughts, can you? Because the vasanas are producing the thoughts. And you don't have control of the vasanas. Ishvara is causing the thoughts to come, the thoughts and the feelings. They come automatically from within yourself. So I can't stop the thoughts, get rid of the feelings and the thoughts. That's not going to happen. But I can step back from those and look at them objectively, and change my relationship to the thoughts. That's called objectivity or control of the mind. And in most meditation paths, they teach you to observe your thoughts. To objectify your thinking. Because most of us are our thinking. We're identified with our thoughts, and when a thought comes, we think, I'm thinking the thought. And we identify with that thought or that feeling. And so in order to inquire and investigate and apply knowledge, I need to have an objective view of my mind. So that's called mind control. The second is fourth qualification is sense control. I need to be able to, if I can't control my mind and my reactions to things, I need to control my senses. My senses will get me in trouble like anything. It's particularly your speech, particularly your tongue. You find yourself in a situation and you say something wrong and you get nothing but trouble, grief. You gossip or you tell a lie or you want to be really honest and you tell a person, you're a jerk. No, I'm just being honest. Don't take offense, but you're a jerk. You may be a jerk, but if I tell you you're a jerk, I'm going to have a lot of problems, aren't I? First of all, I'm going to feel guilty for injuring you. So I'm going to get a disturbance there. And you're going to be what? Thinking a lot of bad thoughts about me, which is going to come back and somehow start affecting me. Eating too much sex, etc., etc., over-exercising, all kinds of things. The sense organs should be disciplined and well-controlled. Look at the Gita. Our habits should be moderate and reasonable. I need to be able to control my senses, control my mind, control my... Okay, then this one we talked about already. I don't have to make a big story about it. Swadharma. Take care of my own business. Stop manipulating and controlling other people by trying to help them. You're not meant to help anybody unless they request help. And secondly, Swadharma means not try to be something that you're not. If you're trying to be spiritual and create a big spiritual persona, and want yourself to think you're spiritual and other people to think you're spiritual, then you're not doing your Swadharma. You're inauthentic and you're building a personality that you're going to have to get rid of later on. So Swadharma, not just keeping to yourself and taking care of yourself and not trying to be something that you're not. What's next? Samadhana. Samadhana means what? The ability to keep concentrated on a particular topic for a long period of time. Single-pointedness of mind. And to do that, you need to what? Love the truth. If you love something, it's not hard to keep your mind single-pointed, is it? When something is that you love, your mind sticks to it all the time. So you need to love this search for knowledge. You need to love knowledge. Then what else? Forbearance. It's called titiksha. That means what? Not getting myself disturbed about the little pinpricks of life. There are lots of things in life that I don't like and I don't want. And Bhagavan puts me in situations all the time where I have no control over the circumstances. And for titiksha means I man up, shut up, and put up with what it is in good humor and wait until it goes away. Like my mother-in-law.
Everywhere the same.
I'm going to treat her nicely because I love my wife. And my wife loves her mother, but my mother-in-law doesn't like me, and I don't like her. And my mother-in-law wants to come on the weekends and tell me what a slob I am and how useless I am when I'm laying on the TV drinking my beer and watching the sports. And tell my wife that she should have married somebody, you know, who was worth something instead of this jerk that I am. And I don't like it, and I don't like her, and I don't want her there, but she's there, and so I just better just be a decent, pleasant person and put up with it until she goes on Monday morning. That's called titiksha. Forget it. If you don't have that, forget it.
Patience? How did you call it?
Titiksha, it's called. It means forbearance. And two more. Real important. Burning desire for liberation. Mumukshutva. Burning desire for liberation. Not middling, burning. It has to be really all I want. Most of us, you know, well, we do want moksha, but we've got other little things we'd like to have too, right? I would like, it's good, I do want enlightenment, but I don't mind having a relationship and a good job and a little foreign travel and, you know, it's right? Burning desire. I want it bad. It happened to me. I came to a point when I was 25, and I would have rather died than live one more day in my life.
Why?
I wanted freedom so bad. I was so unhappy and so miserable, and I got this incredible, absolute, intense desire to be free. And I just was not interested in anything else. I totally did not care about anything in the world at all. Money, sex, I was very young. Money, sex, power, you name it. I couldn't care less. All I wanted was to be free. And that desire attracted my guru to me. And then finally, if it's just a half-assed desire, then you're just going to get half-assed results. That's all. So burning desire, I really, really, really know this is what I want. And I'm ready, it imbues me with a spirit of renunciation. The spirit of what? Letting go. I'm happy to let go of those things that are standing in the way of what I want. I'm really happy to burn down this house that ignorance built. I'm ready to throw it all on the fire. Really ready. I will do without anything. I will suffer like a dog, but I want out. That's the feeling. All these people that got enlightened, it was always the truth. You read Byron Katie's story? Huh? It's a good example. Eckhart Tolle, another example. Milarepa, huh? Etc., etc., etc. All of these people had a burning desire to be free. Yeah.
Is it the most important qualification? Okay.
Well, yeah. Yes. If you have that, then all the other qualities will develop very quickly. But then finally, Some teachers say this is the most important qualification. Assuming you have that, you better have faith in the scripture. Now this is called Shraddha, S-H-R-A-D-D-H-A, Shraddha. And it's a peculiar kind of faith. It's not blind faith. Okay?
It's not rock band, so to say.
Yeah, it's not a blind faith. It's not like religion. In religion, you either believe in God or you don't. But there's no way for you to know who God is there? You ask these religious people, they have no idea who God is. They don't know. But they really, really, really believe that there is a God. This is why they're so difficult. Because they're ignorant. Well, the faith that we're talking about in Vedanta is called faith pending the result of your investigation. That means we're going to give you tools to prove to you, to reveal to you who you are and what reality is. And we're going to show you how to use those tools. And then you should believe that those things work and that you are okay, huh? And until you've experienced and known it yourself. So it's pending the result of your investigation. Yes, ma'am.
So, as you said, we do it by experience?
Yeah.
Okay.
Experience and knowledge, absolutely.
Can we find ourselves by experience?
Sure.
Yes, I know.
No, you will.
It is not possible.
It is possible.
Okay.
Knowledge and experience are one. If reality is non-dual, experience and knowledge are one.
Okay.
We're not against experience. You will experience. You can experience something and not know what you're experiencing. But if you have the right understanding, if you understand the relationship between knowledge and experience, then when you experience yourself, you'll know what yourself is.
This was the other way around with Eckhart Tolle. He didn't know.
He didn't.
When he, and then later on he got the knowledge to it.
That's right. And later on he got the knowledge to it. Absolutely. So if there's a problem on your spiritual path, then it's one or several of these qualifications are lacking. Your dispassion is bad, your discrimination is bad, you don't want it bad enough, huh? Your desire, huh? And so forth. Your faith in the teaching and the teacher is not up to speed.
So how do you bring together this passion and burning desire for qualification?
That is absolutely necessary, but burning desire means I'm ready to what? I'm ready to do whatever it takes. And then I sit down and take it easy. I'm dispassionate with reference to the result, and I'm ready to do the work according to what the scripture tells me. Now, that's only part of it. What? I need a teacher. Because I can't work this out on my own. If I could work it out on my own, I'd have worked it out on my own. I'm a good person. I'm an intelligent person. I'm a sincere person. Why can't I work? How can't I get rid of my ignorance myself? It's too close to me, and I don't have the tools for doing it. So I need to be taught. So I need not only a valid means of knowledge, Vedanta, and qualifications, I need a teacher. And the teacher should be qualified. Oh, look at this. Look at how complicated this is getting. This is a big mess. You get teachers like Eckhart, they're not qualified to teach. They're qualified, they get enlightened, but they have no teaching. They just talk about awareness. And they just tell your own experience. Well, that doesn't do any good. Everybody loves Eckhart, and they all get inspired by Eckhart, and so forth and so on. And after a month or two, the power of now ends up with the collecting dust on the bottom of the shelf with all the other spiritual books. And they run off to Adyashanti, or they run off to Gurumayi, or Gangaji, or somebody else, and then they go hop around from one to another, and there's hundreds of enlightened people out there, but they have no teaching. Their teaching is just their experience. But if I fall in love, you don't fall in love. I'd love to. I'm in love. I'm in love with my wife. Well, can I transfer that to you so you can be in love with whoever you want to be into? No, you can't. And my experience of enlightenment doesn't transfer to you. So experience isn't going to do the job. And on top of it, now listen to this. Ignorance is hardwired. Huh? Ignorance is so deep and so tenacious. And I take my ignorance to be knowledge. On top of it, the minute I pop out of the womb, the minute I'm born here, my parents and the world starts filling me with ignorance. Very minute, these are the people that love me. And I don't know anything, I'm innocent. I'm just a little baby, I don't know anything. And I depend for my survival on my parents, and my parents start dumping crap on me, huh? The minute I'm born. And I take it to be the truth. How do I know? I have no discrimination. I don't know anything. And I keep building on my ignorance. I keep adding more and more ignorance. I keep developing it and developing and developing it. Huh? And I'm attached to it. I believe that how I see things is how it is. It's my truth, people say. I tell them about the truth. You say, well, never mind with the truth. What about my truth? Well, there's no my truth. There's the truth, and your truth is ignorance. It's not truth. It's just what you believe. It's just what you think. It's just what you feel. It's just your fantasies or your desires or your fears. That's all it is. It doesn't count for anything except suffering. It just ends up producing suffering. It's a problem. Yes, ma'am.
What do you think about the kind of investigation Byron Katie does?
Byron Katie's method is very good for removing projections.
Yes.
It's not good for moksha. But it's good for removing projections. It's not very sophisticated because there's a problem with it. One problem with it, I shouldn't know why I'm getting off on this topic, but when you ask if it's true,
mm-hmm.
And then you say, is it really true?
Mm-hmm.
Isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
Well, what does truth mean there? What's her idea of truth?
I think she really means that it's too much for the mind, but something happens in the mind.
Yeah, it's vague. You're not the one to, unless you know what truth is. Is it true? That what she means, is it true for you? Does she?
Mm.
Huh? Does she mean, is it true for you?
Mm.
Or is it true for anybody? Because the truth is good for everybody.
Yeah.
But, huh? I don't know what she means by it. But when I heard that, everybody was really big on Byron Katie some years ago when she became famous. I don't hear that much about it anymore, but I thought, well, okay, you say, is it true? Well, okay, what does truth mean to me? What does it mean?
But she asked, can you be 100% sure that this is true?
Yeah, and
more than my truth.
Yeah, okay, now, and you can't, and you can't. You know, the answer is no.
Yeah, it's no.
The answer is
<It's always.
laughs> And the answer is always no. Or who would I be without this idea, huh? Well, I'd be happy without it. You know, who would I be without this belief or this idea? I'd be happy without it. But no, it's okay. But it's not a means of knowledge for awareness, but it does have a good psychological impact. It is because, particularly, it's entry level, it's psychological work, but you need to work on yourself and remove your projections before you can get dispassionate. So it helps you to develop the qualifications. Well, actually, I think it's a pretty good little method. I don't really have any criticism of that. Okay, so here we are. There's no joy in objects. Freedom, I want freedom only. Freedom is not experiential, it's not an experience. It's only knowledge of who I am because I'm already free. I need a means of knowledge. For a means of knowledge, I need to be qualified. And I need a qualified means of knowledge, and I need to be qualified, and I need a teacher, and I need a qualified teacher. I don't need somebody who's enlightened. Hanging out with an enlightened person, I can get just as much ignorance as I got anywhere else. The enlightened people are, just because I know who I am doesn't make me a teacher. And it doesn't mean that what I say is a teaching. This is a very big problem in the spiritual world. Oh, he's enlightened, she's enlightened. Let's go hang out with him. We'll get it like that. Or like by osmosis, oh, the Shakti, or transmission, like the Zen people. Oh, you just sit there and the Roshi just. You get transmission, and then you'll be enlightened. It's not experiential, it can be transmitted. That's not a teacher, according to our tradition. What is a teacher? Someone who has been set free by the means of knowledge and can wield the means of knowledge effectively and has the temperament of a teacher and is compassionate and walks the talk. How many of these people out there say they're enlightened, huh, and live like pigs? Live no different than they lived before, huh? And they say, oh, that's not me. That's not me. You're just projecting that. That's just my body mind. Yeah. That's not me at all. It's your problem. You're seeing something here that isn't here at all. And they just keep right on robbing and stealing and screwing everything that walked and carrying on, just exactly like before, going for fame, collecting money, etc., 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 talking big, presenting themselves as if they're enlightened, and so forth and so on. This spiritual world is so corrupt. Believe me, it is so hopelessly corrupt.
And there's
so much money in it. And there's huge, yeah, there's money in it, there's sex in it, there's power in it. All the things that are in the worldly world are in the spiritual world.
Misuse of power.
Misuse of power, right and left. My God, it's so scary how much there is. So I'm walking in a minefield, and Vedanta's got, that's why we're, and do these modern teachers, do they tell you that you need to be qualified?
No.
No? Do they? Well, they don't tell you at all. They don't want to tell you. Why? Because there won't be anybody there.
No money.
There'll be no money coming. There'll be no power coming. There'll be no respect coming. A lot of them are not money or sex crazed. A lot of them are lonely people. They're needy people. They want love. And they feel it. If you're paying attention to me, you love me. So if I could get more people paying attention to me, I must be more lovable. And so they're all feeding on the Shakti, on the energy. And the cults of personality that develop. You see, like you go to Muji and those places. They're all into the Shakti, into the feeling of being high. It's a nice feeling. It's a lovely feeling. It's a love energy. It's a good energy and so forth and so on. But I have no teaching. And we say, well, the problem is ignorance. You need some means of knowledge and you need a teacher. Then what happens? Okay, you're qualified. You got a good teacher. Huh? Then you're taught what the self is and you're given the methods of inquiry. These are just techniques or tools. We give you a whole toolkit. What's the number one tool? Karma Yoga. That's your big shovel and pick. You're given Karma Yoga right off the bat. How many teachers really teach Karma Yoga in the modern spiritual world?
No one.
In yoga, yes.
Maybe in yoga. Yeah, in yoga you'll get it. In some of the yogas. But a lot of the yoga teachings are just about doing selfless service. Selfless service is not karma yoga. There's no such thing as selfless service. Every service you do is for the self. And karma yoga is an attitude you take with respect to action and its results. It's scientific. And it applies to every activity in the world. You don't have to be in an ashram or anything to do karma yoga. You don't have to hang out with a guru to do karma yoga. Karma yoga is just how you relate to what you're doing. That's all it is. So then you're given all these practices, these teachings, and then you're sent off to what? Do the work.
Thank you for listening. For more information about Vedanta, yoga and self-inquiry, visit shiningworld.com, yogavidya.de or meinyogalehrer.de.